This is a Harper Guys production.
The following will contain adult subject matter and may not be suitable for all audiences.
How does a murderer get out of jail after just 9 years?
Welcome to the gallows.
This is Jake. With me, as always, my co-host Adam.
Yo.
Just the quick beginning that we always have on the show for the things going on in the world of capital punishment. We are still on pace, as of right now, to have Billy Wardlow on 7-8, so that is 1 week from today. Looks like Billy's going to be coming up.
I hope so, because I really don't like his last name.
You tired of hearing Billy Wardlow?
Wardlow. How did you grow up with that name?
I don't know.
No wonder he got all crazy.
Well, you're going to have to hear it one more time once we confirm what had happened.
And Billy then, Wardlow.
Yes.
And that's hard to say.
Then there may be a show about it afterwards. Following Billy, like we had mentioned on the last show, are the string of federal executions for the first time in a long time. On 7-13, it's Daniel Lewis Lee. On 7-15, it is Wesley Perky. On 7-17, it is Dustin Lee Hocken. And there is one more that they haven't announced yet. So Ohio still has everything stayed. So it is what it is there. So we'll see. It looks as of right now like we're going to end up with 4 states by the end of the year that will have had executions. So we'll see if it ends up being that way or not.
Do we have an update on our buddy Ruben Gutierrez?
Yeah, he has that 60-day stay that's in place to where
he's
back on the table for September.
September.
So as we get closer, okay, we'll make sure that we bring him back up.
Note to self.
Yes.
Shut up about Ruben until September. Okay.
Time to give him the screwdriver treatment, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's kind of – I wish that they would get to that point again, but we won't get to that.
Yeah.
So tonight's story starts off just a little bit different. Kind of starts at the end. On June the 27th of 2018, there were 18 protesters outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas. They were protesting the death sentence for a man that had committed 2 murders. He had admitted to 2 more, and he was actually suspected in as many as 25 murders and dozens of rapes, some of which were actually confirmed. This guy was 66 years old at the time, in a wheelchair, so he's paraplegic, cannot walk. His legs were basically useless. He had Parkinson's, so he had the full-on shakes, and he actually was struggling at this point to talk audibly, which made sense. So this is what this monster had been reduced to within 15 years of him actually being on death row. By the time they were at this point, the defense team only had one option left that they were going after to try to get his execution changed over to a commuted life sentence, and that was because of his declining health. That basically, natural causes are going to take him anyway, so what are we actually looking for here, you know?
Right.
Well, there was no contention of that he was innocent or improper handling or anything like that. You know, to where that makes it kind of strange, because when you get down to this point, you know, when you're doing your writ of habeas corpus, those type of things, it's usually them trying to say, well, it was okay. Like, he didn't really do this. There's evidence that points another direction. With this, there was none of that. It was unquestionable that this guy had done this, right? So while the protesters are out there, there's one woman that's standing outside. And she's maybe 40, 50 feet away from the protesters, not saying anything. She's just kind of watching. And people had remarked that she stood there most of the time with her arms crossed, and she just had this like weird little smirk. And at one point in time, one of the other protesters said, "Hey, you know, you can come join us if you want to." And she said, "No, I'm not here for that." So as it got time, we were getting within about 30 minutes of the execution taking place here. She gets back into her car in front of all these people and heads for the gate. This lady's name was Tara Robinson, and Tara Robinson had been waiting for this day for 20 years. So 20 years prior, 1998, Tara is staying at a hotel in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. She'd gone down to visit some friends for a long weekend, and she was an attractive girl in her mid-20s, and this is like pre-CrossFit era, but she was known for being in incredibly good shape. She was a dominant high school athlete that excelled in track and basketball. She was actually an all-state basketball player in Texas, which is a big deal. I mean, a state as large as Texas, to be all-state, you got to be pretty good.
Absolutely.
So on November the 8th of 1988, she was at a small tavern with her group of friends on the last night of her stay, and she was staying at a hotel just a couple blocks away. And so she finishes off the night with a couple extra drinks. She knows that she's walking, so she doesn't really think that there's any big deal about it. So she decides, finally, you know, everybody's gone home. The night's over. It's time to head back to her room. Well, as she opens the door, she feels a push from behind. And before she knows it, she's face down on her hotel room floor, and her clothes are being cut off. Like, in a matter of seconds, this is just all happening so fast. So he gets her completely undressed, rolls her over, and begins to rape her. Well, instead of screaming, she just stares at him, like with this intense hate, just right at him, not giving in one inch whatsoever, just this feeling of hate that she's projecting toward him. Well, this caused the assailant, who she would later describe as being somewhere between 5'7 and 5'9, somewhere right around 200 pounds, and in his early 50s, maybe as low as his late 40s, well, he starts to lose his erection. He's not getting the joy and the pleasure out of this. So he starts to become frustrated. Well, Tara, she's like, starts laughing at him and starts making fun of him. You know, she tells him that he's not even a man. You know, you can't even do this right. What is wrong with you? You're a complete fail. I mean, just starts berating this guy.
Wow.
Right? So, you know, starts challenging his manhood. At one point, she actually said, "You're a piss poor rapist." I mean, to me,
I'm sorry to laugh, but this is like spot on.
All right, but I mean, that's balls, no matter how you want to phrase it.
It's great. I love it.
Right? So he gets pissed off. So he's like, you know what? Enough of this. So he gets up and he actually bounds her hands together, and then takes a shirt and ties it around her mouth and like ties it behind her head to gag her. So she's got just her feet done and her hands. And then he has a large duffel bag that he actually like drops her down into and like closes up the duffel bag. And he goes in to take a shower.
Well, so she's in a duffel bag now.
Yeah. In her own room. Right.
Holy crap.
And this guy decides it's time to take a shower. You know, doesn't want to leave any evidence. I don't know. To me, that's not the move I would expect from an asshole rapist at that point in time. So she hears the water start running, and she waits about a minute, and she hears the shower curtain close, and she decides, all right, it's go time. So she actually uses her feet to get the bag open, and then she uses her right big toe to get in between and get her hands undone, which then obviously uses to get the covering off of her face, right? So she looks around the room real quick. She grabs a t-shirt and a pair of shorts, and she heads down to the office of the hotel. Now, the guy that was actually working at the desk would go on to say later that she strolled in like nothing was to matter at all. She walks up to the clerk, and she says, excuse me, I just want to let you know that I was just raped. And, well, he actually tried to rape me, you know, and he's actually in this room number right now taking a shower. The worker kind of just like froze and like didn't know what to do. And he actually walked out from behind, and he just walked out of the whole place. So Tara takes matters into her own hands again.
This lady's like my hero.
She walks around behind the desk and calls the police herself. So they arrive within like 3 minutes, and they take this guy into custody. I mean, how badass is this chick to go?
She's awesome.
To go through this like a champ. I mean, I'm sure that there was a residual effect later on for this whole thing, but to handle yourself and keep your shit together like that.
Pretty
much
in charge, even though she wasn't in charge. She's pretty much in charge.
Exactly. So they get him down to the station, and They run its prints, and they find out very quickly this is a gentleman named Mark Paul Bible, just like the King James Version, Bible. And he gets sat down, and he asks for a pack of Winston Full Flavors and a Bible. And they said, well, what are we going to get in return? You know, like, you know how cops are in that moment. They're going to give you something. They're going to want something in return. He said, I want you to give me those two things, and I'm going to go to sleep, and I'll talk to you in the morning. That he had some thinking to do. So reluctantly, they agreed. And the next morning, they bring him back in. They get him sit down in the interrogation room. And there's actually audio tape of this that you can find online. And he said, yes, I will talk to you. They ask him like four different times, are you sure you want to talk to us without a lawyer? And he's like, yeah. He said, you know what? I'm actually going to start at the beginning. So Bible starts off by saying that he wanted to guarantee from them that based off of what he tells them, that he's not going to get the death penalty. Well, Detective Randy Walker is the lead investigator at the time. He assured him that he would not be coming after him for the death sentence. And that's exactly how he worded it. And that satisfied Bible as far as the answer went. But what he didn't know is Walker doesn't have the authority to make a promise like that, right? He said he wasn't coming after him. That don't mean the state, the district attorney, or somebody like that is going to come after him, right? So Bible begins to talk. And some of the story they had known because they already had his past history, but he decides to start telling them the whole thing from the beginning. So let's go back another 20 years from there, right? So 1979, we have a lady named Inez Denton. She's a cheery 20-year-old. She had graduated the year before. And like a lot of adults, she stayed at home, you know, to live for a while, but she didn't want to be home. You know, she was always wanting to go different places and things. You got to remember, this is 1979, just for the context, right?
Can we back up just 1 second?
Sure.
So how did the officers after the rape know that he had more to tell?
They didn't until they got him in there.
And then he just started.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Is they wanted to start interrogating him about the rape, and he was like, I got more story to tell, but I need to sleep on it first.
Okay. So it was just more story to tell. Okay.
Yeah. And they were like, oh, okay. Gotcha. This is why they gave in, because They're like, well, we're going to get some more. And they actually, once they had announced that they had somebody in custody for this whole thing, they actually interviewed the investigator on TV, and he was like, we don't know what we're going to get. This could be smoke and mirrors and could be nothing, or we could be getting some good information about other things that have happened. We don't know yet. We'll keep you posted.
Okay. So right? 79.
Right. So back in 79, we got little Inez Denton. And like a lot of kids, like I said, she doesn't want to be at home. So she's trying to make some plans for the evening, right? This is June the 27th of 79 to be exact. So she's trying to make some plans, but there's no cell phones, right? And her brother had actually acquired a girlfriend at the time, and he was on the phone for a couple of hours, you know? So not weird for the time, I didn't think, if you know your neighbors and where you're from. She decides that she's going to head next door to use the phone, you know, like, hey, can I use your phone real quick? You know, people that have all known each other for a long time. And their next door neighbor was a very sweet woman. She was in her mid-50s, and her name was Mrs. Bible. I'll leave her first name out of it for protection on the show. She hasn't done anything wrong here.
Sure.
Her husband had actually passed away at a pretty young age, to where she was one of these ladies in the neighborhood that was just known for taking care of the kids as their own. You know, if they needed lunch money or, you know, they needed food, anything like that, she was always there just looking out and kind of taking care of anything. Well, on this particular afternoon, she wasn't home. She was actually out working at the time, but Danny, who was her nephew, was actually at the house. And according to the story that he told, she came over and she asked if she could use the phone. And he said that what she was wearing was basically like a sheer sheet crop top with no bra and shorts that were basically underwear. And to him, she came over looking for some action, and he was going to give it to her. So, Yeah, I'm not a believer that what a girl wears is a pass for you to take it that anything's going to happen, you know?
I mean, if you've ever been at the mall.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Some of the young ladies walk around not wearing a whole lot. It doesn't give you a reason to take advantage of them.
No, that's them being comfortable with themselves. Like, it's just not an okay thing. Well, he decides he's going to start flirting with her a little bit, you know? And at one point, he grabs her and he kisses her. Well, she pushes him away and says that she's going to run home and tell her father. Well, this sends him into a rage. So he brutally rapes her and beats her, and then he loads her into the back of his car, and he heads towards Houston. He found a field about 10 miles from the city, and there was a creek that kind of ran through the edge of the field, and he actually propped her up like a mannequin to look like she was waving. So if anybody could actually see down in there from the one road, it looked like she was just waving to whoever was passing by.
That's weird.
Right. Well, after one pedestrian saw her 2 days in a row, because it was not a heavily trafficked area, they called it in. The cops actually go down, investigate the situation. They find out that she has passed away. Upon determination, they find out that she's been missing for 11 days. The coroner determines that she had been dead for 11 days, and she had upwards of 15 stab wounds from an ice pick. So, I mean, that's a pretty brutal way to go.
Extremely brutal.
Well, the problem, though, was with how long she'd been gone in Texas, decomposition had set in, and to where, other than being able to decipher the knife wounds, they didn't find really anything else to help them in the situation, right? So as police start their investigation on this, Bible Danny actually gets questioned as one of the neighbors, but he was never listed as a suspect. It's like, hey, did you see anything? Did you hear anything? Like, what did you know? Yada, yada, yada. And a few days later, he comes home and he tells his aunt, he said, hey, you know, I'm going to be cutting out of town here. I actually found some work in Montana, which didn't seem like a big deal. Not somebody that was on anybody's radar, known as a pretty nice guy, you know, just no red flags were coming up. So he heads up to Montana, and just outside of Helena, Montana, he meets this young woman named Maddie. She's 22 and he's 30, right? So there's a little bit of an age difference, but it didn't really matter to her. He found work as an electrician. He was really known as like a handy guy. I mean, he could do any kind of housework, stuff like that. Was good with like small motors, all of those kind of things. You know, they would find out later he kind of grew up doing that kind of stuff, you know. And they kind of settled in into some semblance of a normal life, right? So he gets there in 79. In 1982, she becomes pregnant and actually has a miscarriage. Well, this is where their relationship begins to just fall apart. He resented her for the whole thing, blamed the miscarriage on her, that it was her fault, and they begin to fight often. Well, what started off as verbal fights ended up escalating into physical fights, and he would punch her in the stomach, in the shoulder, and he even punched her one time in the jaw so hard that it broke her jaw and ripped an abrasion on her cheek, where she ended up having to have 5 stitches put into it, right?
Nice guy.
So after one such argument, after this, I mean, she never did press charges for any of that kind of stuff, which to me, I don't understand the victim mentality on that, but it does happen. You know, I'm sure that in hindsight, this lady wishes that she would have said something. So Bible heads down to the library, right? Just get out of there, go kind of clear his head a little bit. And he goes in and he sees this young girl sitting by herself. So he went over and asked what she was working on, and she was working on her math homework. It was actually geometry, what was what they would determine later. So he was actually pretty decent at math, so he sits down and starts helping her out with it, you know? So after they're working for about an hour and she gets her homework done, he said, hey, you know, there's a nice little cheeseburger joint across the street. You know, I'm hungry after all this. You want to go grab a cheeseburger? And unsuspecting kid, you know, hey, you just helped me out with your homework? Yeah, I'll go get a cheeseburger. That sounds good. So he gets her outside, and his car was parked right in front of the library. And he actually hit her in the back of the head with a blunt object. He never said what that was. They couldn't determine what it was. And he throws her again into the back of his car, takes her back to his apartment, which is kind of in a rundown kind of area. You know, people aren't asking a lot of questions, you know, and he actually doesn't move her into the apartment until that evening. And he held her for 6 days, where he beat and raped her continually. For 6 days.
Jesus.
I can't imagine what those 6 days seemed like. It had to be an eternity. But he said that he got to a point where he knew that she was hurting and that she was scared. And that triggered something in him to where he didn't want to hurt her anymore. He had actually hoped that this girl was going to fall in love with him. So he decided that he was going to take her back. So he actually dropped her off right in front of the library where he had picked her up. She went straight to the police department. They called her parents. I mean, obviously overjoyed that their daughter is found and alive, you know, regardless of the circumstances that they're dealing with now. And instantly, I mean, for the time, it's not like the way it is now to where you can get an Amber Alert out and people know what's going on immediately, but they got an APB out on this guy looking for him. Well, he gets rid of his car same day, gets a different car, different plates, you know, with his 30-day tag on it. And
still think that'd be traceable a little bit.
you would have to think, but you got to know what you're looking for at that point in time. I mean, at that point in time, she doesn't know his real name. They're basically looking for a car description. Well, she doesn't know where she was being kept. Right, but even once the car is gone, it's not as simple as it is now. You know,
true.
Now they would check databases, get a hold of every used car lot in the area. You know what I mean? They could track that stuff down pretty quick. I'm sure back then, it took a little bit more time.
Sure.
Well, by the time this is going on, he switched out cars, and he is on his way back to Florida, right? So he doesn't want to go back to where he's originally from, so he's like, you know what? I'm going to go to Florida. Well, down in Florida is where his ex-sister-in-law, Tracy Powers, and her four-month-old son, Justin, are living at the time. And she actually has a roommate named Pamela Hudgens. So Bible gets down there. She lets him crash at their place for a little bit, and he finds work in a tool and die shop as a maintenance guy. You know, you're pretty handy. That's not a bad place to get in, you know, making sure the machines keep running and stuff. So he would go on to say that he was really, really grateful to Tracy for the entire thing, that he would often bring groceries and try to help out around the house if they had things that needed to be done. Well, part of his ruse was trying to impress Pamela. She was very attractive, blonde, you know, had the dark Florida skin from being in the summer all the time. And she was very much not into it. I mean, just not at all. So it gets to the point where we're in mid-May. It's May the 17th of 1983. And Tracy says, you know what? You got to stop coming over. You're starting to make everybody uncomfortable with the whole situation. And he said, okay. And so he starts packing up his stuff, and she turns around, and when she turns around, he drills her right in the back of the head with a giant flashlight. You ever seen like the 4D? Like, that's what it reminds me of, the way they're describing
it. Maglite.
Right. I mean, and you get hit with a 4D maglite, you're going down, right? So he proceeds to rape her right there in her own home, and then he takes her and her young son, Justin, and he loads them up. And he heads for a place that he knows near Weatherford. There's an overpass down there. So their two bodies would be discovered about a month later. But again, decomposition was so bad that other than the small abrasion on the back of her neck, they really couldn't find anything. So what they basically chalked it up to is that they had probably both been beat to death because they didn't have... they didn't have skull fractures and stuff like that, but you can inflict enough internal damage without breaking a ton of stuff. But there were no stab wounds, no bullet holes, nothing like that. Nothing that would suggest a poisoning, right? So just another absolutely brutal murder, right? So he gets done with this, and this is all in a couple hour period of time here. So he goes back to the apartment. Well, Pamela comes home, and Bible's in there just waiting. And as soon as she walks in the door, attacks her instantly, and this is the first time that the only actual time that they actually have it documented that he would actually drug her. So I don't know if it was like something like a roofie or something like that. So he actually drugs her, physically ties her to the bed, like something you would see out of a movie, and rapes her viciously and repeatedly for 2 days. He actually would say that he raped her as many times as he physically could for 2 days.
Jesus.
I mean, I don't know how you put another human being through that, right? So he finally decided that he had his fill, and he decided to take her to a deserted road. And he ends up leaving her about 15 yards off of the road to where, like, anybody could find her. And it was a pretty well-traveled road at the time. So the next day, a lady's walking. She's just out on her daily walk, and she sees something down in there, and she gets down in. So immediately she goes and she calls the police, and he said the police determined instantaneously that it was blunt force trauma to the head, to where, like, she actually had the full fractured skull, whole nine yards, that had caused internal bleeding on her brain that killed her. Bible, during his interview when he was talking about her, he said that it broke his heart to do this because he knew that it was true love at first sight, but that Pamela just couldn't see it.
This guy. Mental health, baby.
I mean, right? So police start their investigation of Pamela's death now, right? So they know that Tracy's dead, and they know that Pamela's dead and that they were roommates, but they really can't determine anything off of Tracy's death, right? Well, at the house, from all the times that he had been there, they found a receipt from a store that had his name on it, and the blood that they had were able to pull out of the house, actually, some of it had his blood type on it, right? So he was arrested and charged with second-degree murder, as well as kidnapping the little girl in Montana, right? So he gets sentenced to 25 years for Pamela's murder and 20 years for the kidnapping and rape. Okay. 20 years for kidnapping and rape. I feel like it should be stiffer for an 11-year-old girl.
Absolutely.
Like that should be a life sentence right there if you do that to a child.
Yes.
Right? But 25 years for murder, vicious, brutal murder, seems really low. Well, it basically went on to say that he took a plea deal to get that 25 years because they took it. They didn't think that they had enough evidence to where they knew 100% sure that he was going to go to jail. So they thought 25 years is better than the possibility of no years.
Absolutely.
Well, the judge, which I have no idea how this happens, the judge actually allows the sentences to run concurrently. So instead of back to back, they're running simultaneously, right? So he gets into prison, model prisoner, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, gets involved in a bunch of work programs, anything he can do.
Jailhouse Jesus's?
No jailhouse Jesus for this guy, but everything short of that. And he is paroled after 9 years. I tried to think of this as a family member. Can you imagine a family member of yours being brutally murdered and that person is back out on the street in less than a decade?
No.
I can't even imagine what happens. So these are the stories that he's telling while he's in police custody, right? They already know a lot about what's happened. So over the next 48 hours after his initial arrest in Louisiana, he confesses to rapes in 16 states between 1993 when he's paroled and 1998. I mean, right there is a poster child for them getting it wrong, right?
Yes.
And he says, when it comes to murders, I will give you details on every one I've committed, but I will give them to you one at a time after each case is closed. Because he doesn't want to start giving them all this information because his fear is still the death penalty, right? So he thinks, okay, we get through this one. You give me life, I'll give you another one. You give me life. You know, he's going to keep making this trade off and on, but he didn't want to give him everything and put him in a position to where he was going to get it, right? Well, the very first case, obviously, was going to be Inez Denton, right? Well, when it went to the trial, the prosecuting attorney said, nope, we're going for the death sentence. So instantly, Bible changes his entire stance. He pleads innocent and said he would not speak any longer on any of the other murders, especially the ones he hadn't discussed yet. So even if he had already discussed it, won't discuss it again, and he's not giving up any more information, no matter what they do. He gets tried in 2003. He's convicted on July the 16th, and then on July 17th, he's actually sentenced to death. So, in a strange twist of fate, they get done with the hearing at the court on the 17th. They get him loaded up into the transport van, and now they're going to take him to death row, right? So, while he's in the van, a car runs a red light, and they actually have a head-on collision with this vehicle while he's in...
Sounds like a damn movie.
Right, while he's en route of being transported. The driver, who actually worked for the federal prison system, passed away from this, and Bible was actually paralyzed from the waist down permanently. And he would actually have to have over a dozen surgeries to get himself anywhere near close to right, which taxpayer dollars footed that entire bill, which I think is crazy for somebody that's already gotten a death sentence, but it is what it is. But this guy's in a wheelchair the rest of his life. So there's a little bit of karma while he's still alive. Right? Well, his defense team starts to use this as their building block over the next 15 years to try again to get this sentence commuted, right? So in Texas, along with all the other crazy rules and stuff that you have, in order for an execution to happen, there needs to be another crime committed, which we've established with the rapes, right? And the person still needs to be a threat to society. So that's what they're basing it on.
Pretty sure he is.
Well, they're saying, hey, this guy is in a wheelchair. He can't do nothing, you know.
Oh, currently.
Right. I mean, that's what I thought, too, because how many people have been told they're never going to walk again, and then miraculously 5 years later through hard work, they're able, right? Well, needless to say, nobody in the court system was moved by any of this. And his luck finally ran out in 2018 after 15 years on death row. And they gave him a 6/27 of 2018 date that he was gonna be executed. So in his last ditch effort to try to get out of the entire thing, he found out that his lawyer was actually riddled with cancer And his lawyer was basically trying to see this case through to get this guy commuted before he hung it up and tried to live his final few days in some kind of health. Well, he tried to use that against them and say, hey, this guy's worried about his health. He's not doing a good job for me. They said, no, we're not going to accept that. Sorry. So on the last day before his execution, he said, look, I'll talk. I'll give it all to you. I'll give them all to you one at a time, but you got to get this sentence commuted. And the state Supreme Court came in and said, you know what? We see that there is value in being able to close cases and to give closure to families. That being said, we do not feel like it serves the state to keep this man alive any longer because there would be no trust in what he had to say. So it's a two-edged sword on that. I kind of agree with it and I kind of don't. You know what I mean? If he's really going to give information, I think you give him one shot. You know, try this one. If you're right here, okay, then you can tell us another story. But the minute one don't check out, it's off to the curtains, right? So they said no way, so that takes us up to the execution. So for lunch, he's in Texas. He don't get nothing special, right? So he had a chicken patty, some sweet potatoes, cornbread, macaroni and cheese, pinto beans, biscuits, country gravy, a sugar cookie, and a choice of water, tea, or punch to drink. That night, after his meal, he sat in a cell all by himself, watched TV alone, did not request a visitor, denied the request that came in, did not want any clergy, anything like that. Had nothing of a jailhouse Jesus, which in some ways is refreshing to me, right? Yeah. So at 6:10 on this night.
Don't be a poser.
Right. 6:10 comes and the curtain opens at the Huntsville Death House. Danny Bible is strapped to the gurney and they've got two IVs in. Instead of just one, because that was one of the things that they were worried about. You see, earlier in 2018, there were two botched executions, one in Alabama and one in Ohio, to where they had struggled with the IVs. And the one in Alabama, they actually ended up having to postpone until they could get a PICC line put in to where they knew that it was going to go off, to where they didn't want to take a chance down there. So they doubled him up, you know, one in each arm.
Hey, I'm down.
Right. So at 6:12, he's asked for his last words, and he didn't have any. He basically just said, nope, I have no last words, which kind of ironic for somebody that thinks they have a lot of stories to tell, right?
Yeah.
So they double-check the lines one more time, and they push a little bit of saline to make sure everything is going well and that's being accepted into his body. They start pushing the IVs, and he starts to thrash a little bit, and then he breathes deeply. And then one eye closes, and the other one never does. It just keeps twitching and twitching and twitching and twitching. And it twitches for nearly 12 minutes consecutively to where it's hard to say exactly what's going on.
A little creepy.
So he got to the 3-minute mark and he audibly said, ow, that burns. And then he took a deep breath and started to snore. So pundits have used this to try to say that they're inflicting undue harm on him, because whatever they're giving him in the cocktail is actually hurting him at that point in time. Right. So at 6:32, he's pronounced dead. And it's said by eyewitnesses that were on hand that Tara gave a little chuckle as she walked out. Didn't say anything derogatory or anything, but she laughed audibly as she walked out. And they interviewed her afterwards, and she said, I'm glad to see him dead and to know that he has an eternity waiting for him in hell. And he's going to really need that Bible. So that is the story of the crimes and executions of Danny Bible.
Okay.
So a couple questions here about the case. So is it even fathomable to you that you can do 9 years for a murder and rape and get out on any measure?
No, zero measure.
I mean, I hope that this is something that has been looked at and changed in a lot of places, that like there's a mandatory sentence that you can't go below no matter how good you are.
I think a lot of that changed back from the 70s through the 80s and the 90s. I think a lot of that's changed.
I mean, but this trial was in the 2000s. I mean, this is like 03.
Really?
Yeah, that this went through. That's why to me it's kind of like, how are we still giving?
I guess some of these small towns, who knows?
Right, and in Texas, I'm surprised that with their penal system that he was actually able to get parole. That they didn't just deny it, you know?
Well, we're finding out in some cases.
Yeah.
They're not always so tough.
Do you think that happening leaves the state with any kind of liability to the families of the victims that were post-release.
You would think, had they kept him in there.
I mean, I feel like it. I don't know what he would have been like after 25 years in there.
You put him in there for a 50 spot.
Right. I mean, you're dealing with somebody that's ancient when they get out. Not that 70-year-old men aren't capable of doing terrible things.
Still, though, you're going to have a better chance of it not happening as much or as often or whatever.
Yeah. Another question that I had, and this is just because of how I feel personally about this. Do you think that the kidnap and rape of a minor should be worthy of a death sentence on its own?
It should be.
I agree. I think that this is one of the few crimes that you can commit to where you should be on the hook for your life if you do this.
Young boy, young girl, whoever you're raping, yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's got to be some rules and some things to it. If you're 18 and it's your 17-year-old girlfriend and then she turns you in because you broke up, she's crying rape with her being a minor, you're an adult.
No.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there's got to be some stipulations to the whole thing, but a situation like this that's blatant.
If you're a peer to this person and you're their age, that's completely different.
Right.
Like I've said a million times already, every case has to be looked at with, you know, a little bit of common sense.
I agree completely. But in a situation like this, she's 11 years old. This process took almost a week. Undoubtedly, no matter how strong this girl grows up to be, that's going to change you.
Horribly.
And maybe some parts for the better, but definitely some parts for the worse. To where I think that he deserved it just for that. To me, the 20-year sentence for that was kind of a joke. I mean, not that 20 years given away, but he made a decision to do something where he didn't deserve to have those 20 years back.
Exactly.
Right? So another question that I thought was interesting is, given the fact that he was in an accident with the van, you know, where he gets head on, and he's now permanently injured by a vehicle of the state, do you think that that incapacitation should have on any level given him a right at least to a commuted sentence?
No. At worst, the person that ran into the vehicle, maybe, I don't know, gets sued. I don't know. I mean,
I don't know what he got. He could have got vehicle homicide or something because the driver actually passed away.
I mean, that guy probably didn't drive off scot clean. I mean, he probably.
Right. I mean, if something happened later down the road to where you found out that this guy that had been convicted and put on death row actually was innocent, maybe you have a different case on your hands at that point, because he was wrongfully convicted and now he's a paraplegic.
I mean, here's my thought on this. If you have a life sentence without parole,
yes,
or you're sentenced to death, and you're in a vehicle being transported and you almost die,
mm-hmm.
sorry about it.
Right. I agree. I mean, in a situation like this to where it's from his own words, it's clear that this happened, I don't think that there's any question that it is what it is. Take care of him. You know what I mean? Get him back to whatever semblance of health that you can to put him on death row. But other than that, I don't think that he deserves anything better than that. And to know he is the only person to be executed that has become a paraplegic at the hands of the state while he was convicted. Granted, it was that day during a transportation, but
still
kind of an odd thing. And then, as always, the final question. Was justice served in this case?
Finally, yes.
Yes. I agree completely. I think justice was served. I don't know that
a little
justice,
bit late.
Yeah, I don't know that justice was served to Inez's family at the beginning, you know, by him getting 9 years. But I think the end result, finally, but it shouldn't have cost more lives. And who knows what else he actually did do that can be attributed to him from this time period.
Well, let's even back up a little bit. Even if even if you don't get a death penalty for raping a child under 15,
mm-hmm.
you should still get life.
I agree. Completely.
You know?
Yes.
Something more than 9 years on good behavior.
Right. Especially with two sentences like that running concurrently. I mean, that's what I don't get.
How do you give him that?
I don't know. It makes no sense to me.
Cousin of the guy? Jesus.
And there's nothing that explains anywhere in there exactly why somebody would make this decision other than the fact that he was a model prisoner and all that. I mean, but to me, that's almost an oxymoron. A model prisoner. You know what I mean? To me, I don't know. It's crazy. So, yes, I agree. Justice was absolutely served in this case.
When somebody's holding a gun to your face, you're going to be a good person, aren't you?
Yes.
You're going to listen to everything you're told,
right.
Aren't you?
I agree, for sure. You're going to be the best version of yourself trying to get the hell out of there.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I'm glad he finally got what was coming to him. So, c'est la vie, Mr. Babel.
Mr. Babel.
So, that's what we have for you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. Want to give you a reminder, as always. In this case, like all cases, there's definitely mental health issues that arose. Please, if you have any feelings of hurting yourself or somebody else, please reach out. 1-800-622-4357. That's 1-800-622-HELP. Somebody on the other line will be there to help you to make sure that you get the mental help that you need to get yourself back on track. Be strong enough. Make the call.
Absolutely. So, you know, if you're having any of these bad thoughts about, like Jake said, hurting yourself or hurting others, make the call. Do not hesitate. It's very important.
Thank you very much for joining us. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Stay safe.